listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT at 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jurjage in the Ganyagaha language and Munayang in Anishinaabe Mohen, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in both English and French. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, live in studio on Thursday, March 7th, 2024. It is Women's History Month and tomorrow is Women's Day. I hope you celebrate it or mark it in a way that is meaningful to you. A jam-packed show for you this evening. An unvarnished look at how a divorce can explode a family. In Guilt, a Love Story, we will hear from the performer and creator ahead of opening at the Centaur next week. That's at the top of the show. We'll speak to Diane Flax in just a moment. But also, putting a face to industrial pollution. Teasery Dunia Theatre hosts a touring show that examines how industry has impacted the community in Sarnia, Ontario, through the eyes of two young sibling activists. Co-creator and performer Kevin Matthew Wong talks about the Chemical Valley Project with Xander. And ha ha, oh no. After over 40 years of making Montrealers and the world laugh out loud in two languages, shocking news this week when Just for Laughs not only announced it was seeking creditor and bankruptcy protection, but they've laid off most of their staff, and most importantly, at least for us, there will be no festival this summer. Montreal comic and producer Elspeth Wright is among those sharing their thoughts about what this means for the local scene, local comics, and what her hopes are moving forward. That'll be at the halfway mark, and we'll wrap up with Amour, Acide et Noir, a salacious, iconic piece of Quebec dance marking 23 years. It's getting a fresh look with a new generation of performers next week at Agora de la Danse. One of the directors who has been with the show, choreographed by the legendary Daniel Leveillé since the very beginning, will be my guest. We will speak with rehearsal director Justin Gionnet before the end of the hour. You can follow us for updates, images of our guests, and much more on Instagram at UpstageCKUT. That's where you can see a promotional photo of my next guest pouring sand from one hand into the other. I'm really keen to learn more about this solo show coming to Centaur Theatre next Friday, March the 15th, and it is running until the 30th. It's called Guilt, A Love Story. The love story part is in brackets. It's a sharply perceptive and painfully funny one-woman show confronting the unshakable monster that is guilt. And it's inspired by the life and times of one Diane Flax, who we reach in Toronto this evening. Good evening, Diane. Welcome to Upstage.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for being here. So you are a performer and a writer with the show. You hired an outside eye, a director, Lisa Palmer. We'll get to that relationship in just a second. But this is something based on your own life, I understand.
It is indeed, yes. It was a story, when I split from my partner, and I like to call us lesbian insemination revolutionaries, because we were a lesbian couple. We had a baby. It was like back, 20-something years ago when it was a really big deal to, before marriage was legal, and then for us to split up felt to me really added to my guilt.
Right.
And I was kind of subsumed by it for a few years, like really couldn't see a way out. And then I started writing about it, and that really helped.
writing is so often the therapy that we need. I can imagine that you not only felt guilt for yourself and for family, but also, you know, if you're a trailblazer and the first to do something, you feel like other people are kind of looking to you, that you're setting an example. So there might have been people within your community who are like, well, if Diane is doing this, you know, I too can have a family. I too can settle down. I can do the things that people don't expect me to do.
That's exactly right.
There's another dimension here that is so important. It feels personal to me. I'm a Jewish woman, and you're getting into the angle of guilt. For people who may not be in the know about how this word is very weighty as a cultural, religious, family thing, in your words, describe the importance of guilt within the Jewish community.
Well, I say that guilt is... the Jewish default setting.
Setting?
If you're not sure, yeah. So like, if you're not sure what to feel, you should just feel guilt, probably. I grew up with one of those grandmothers who was like the trope. She literally would say to me, it's been 3 days, you couldn't call. I'd be lying on the floor and my stomach dead.
Oh, yeah.
If you afford it.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of thing. And, at the time, I actually gave me a lot of empathy, and I would joke about it so much. But then when guilt really came for me, I realized, oh, I don't have any tools to get out of this. And I started to realize, like, it felt to me like I had this raccoon in a cage inside my chest at all time that was sort of scraping away at me, and I couldn't get rid of it. In the play, I actually embody the raccoon. I become the raccoon. So that'll be fun for people to see.
Well, expect no less from you're a Torontonian, I assume. The reference to raccoons is a leitmotif of the Toronto experience.
Yeah, they're really cute with their little hamburger eyes, but they have opposable thumbs, and they can order, Uber Eats from your phone. Like, they're really smart and really scary, and the raccoon sort of serves as my id, the person who calls me a selfish piece of whatever, and points out every, throughout the play, I didn't want to talk about guilt and talk about how guilty I felt and how I felt like I was a monster and actually have people feel bad for me. So I have the raccoon who's basically saying, oh, yeah, I talked at one point about how I don't feel people change unless they're backed up against a wall of razor blades or there's a river of chocolate flowing at their feet that they can dive into. And then I say, I had razor blades in my marriage, and then I become the raccoon saying, what? Oh, you grew apart? Oh, big whoop. You were unhappy? Grown-ups don't have a right to be happy. So it's really the thoughts that you think that plague you when you're in a situation where you have been a person as a, maybe, I'm a Jewish mom, so I kind of was one of those moms who would feed myself last, eat the burnt toast kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody even rolled their eyes at my kid in a restaurant, I wanted to murder them. So here I was hurting my own kids. So that's the kind of thing that I felt I had to deal with.
It's so interesting, though, to hear you talk about guilt almost as your superpower or a way for you to navigate in the world, that it gave you a sense of empathy because your grandmother would be guilting you for not calling often enough. And then am I correct in assuming that you realize it's something that's actually kind of blocking you?
100%. But at the same time, the reason I wrote this was because I think people are generally not comfortable with the feeling of guilt, not just for themselves. But for other people, I can't tell you how many people told me, you have to take the oxygen mask first. You're like, you shouldn't feel guilty. And I was like, but you know what? No human mom on the planet Earth will take the oxygen mask first. We will always give it to our kids first. So of course I'm going to feel guilty, it makes people uncomfortable. But at the same time, I feel like there is something to the feeling that's important and that's useful in our society. Freud described it as a feeling of fear, and that it creates a conscience. So maybe there's something to it that is useful and that makes you into a human being,
I'm speaking with Diane Flax, who is the playwright and performer in Guilt, A Love Story, coming to the Centaur next Friday and running until March 30th. I guess you have to ask yourself the question, Diane, if you're the same Diane or the same person without your guilt, if you manage to, dismantle it.
Oh, it's such a great question. I think this is something that women need to look at really seriously. Are we powerful? Who are we without our sort of ability to capitulate and to make people happy and to please and take care of people and feel bad if we're not perfect or if we're not good, quote, good. You know, one thing I talk about in the play is you kind of need to stand on your own feet and be your whole self. The guilt was stopping me from being myself. Oh. It was something I was super comfortable and familiar with, as you probably are, but it wasn't truly who I am.
Diane, how do you go about setting the scene of what your family is? You described it very succinctly at the top of our conversation about how you felt like a trailblazer, a gay couple, being able to have kids, doing something before everyone else, not everyone else was doing it before it was legal, or I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. How do you set that up to the audience and kind of share all of those years of history in a way that people take it in, but then you explode it?
Well, I like to, you know, I do a lot of this through humor, and the word that you use is explode, and that's exactly what happens in the play, is I set the play up by talking about how guilt is actually good. It's a good thing. Our society needs it. We're living in a society where without guilt, we have no moral guideposts. We have, you know, we have Trump, we have Putin, right? So guilt is actually something we need in this time, and people should have more of it, and it's good. And then basically what the audience is going to hear is they're going to hear the sound of a explosion. And then basically I start talking about what kind of a mother I was and how I was kind of a self-sacrificing mother. And I very rapidly talk through who I was and who my ex was at the beginning of our journey together, because I think it's really important to set the stage and not flinch about the fact that, you know, we were trying to do something really important. And I wasn't, you know, I'll just say this. Sorry, I keep interrupting myself, but I will say this. In our zeitgeist, when I was researching this, I saw so many pieces of fiction and media that were about divorce that showed either the woman as the victim, the woman as the other woman, or the woman as deranged. But I didn't really see a woman who just ended her marriage. And how was that? And how did she navigate her children? Just a person. So that's the perspective that I'm trying to offer. And in order to offer that, I got to go back. And I sort of describe my family as this kind of gray gardens, gorgeous, rambling, structurally unsound house, you know. And when you are a trailblazers in the way, a lesbian couple, we're kind of inventing it and inventing our template of what a family is. So just to sort of really give a background in how when something is changed or transformed or dismantled, what the effect can be.
This is your fifth solo show. You're saying it's your most autobiographical one so far as well. So you make a living telling stories about yourself. But was this harder to do than most? I mean, to talk about ending a marriage and how to navigate that?
It was insanely hard. And my other work, you know, I also write for TV and I write for, and I've done, you know, a CBC Radio's parenting columnist for almost 8 years. Mm-hmm. So To do this was very challenging, and with the support of Elisa Palmer, my director, and our amazing design team, I was encouraged every step of the way. And every time I even did it, like a 5-minute bit from this, I was encouraged by people who said, you know, you're telling my story, or this needs to be out there, or I'm feeling I need to hear this, I need to see this. So it allowed me to sort of stretch the person. So it isn't me exactly, but I'm using the parts of my life and my story that really serve drama and comedy in order to connect with the most people.
You mentioned your director, Elisa Palmer, there. People know her from National Theatre School and many other productions. Mm-hmm. Could you have done this without her? You guys have collaborated before.
There would definitely be no show without her, in my opinion. She's amazing. I think she also directed the adaptation of Anne-Marie MacDonald's Fall on Your Knees. I was in that tour. That just happened last year. She can move, you know, she can adapt an enormous book into 6.5 hours of theater, and then she's working on my 75-minute one-person show. So she's really incredible. She encouraged me to go deep into this autobiographical material and to expand it, because for me, I needed to take it out of my own personal story in order to make it palatable for an audience and myself. But the other thing that Lisa did is she really pushed me to be the goofiest version of myself.
The goofiest?
Lisa really believes in comedy and the power of comedy, as do I, to engage an audience. So that was totally crucial.
There's some terrific production photos up on the Centaur website, I'm assuming from the Tarragon production that you just wrapped in Toronto. And you can tell that it's both dramatic and comedic at the same time. If I can say that, like, you can see the comedy kind of flowing through the photos.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Do you find that you can still laugh at your own jokes? I mean, I know you've written for Kids in the Hall as well. Like, you know how to write comedy. Like, do you find yourself thinking, like, yeah, this material is good, even if it's difficult?
Well, you know what I do find is, as I enjoy when I make myself giggle, or I go, this is too much, or this is too far, that's when I know that I'm almost there. So I think, you know, we can't help it. Like, the goofiest moments, the funniest moments of life, are often where we find the most humor, where we can mine the most humor. And how do we get through any moment of difficulty? Most people, and I wouldn't say just twisted souls like myself, use gallows humor, even if you don't know you're doing it, you know?
Diane, you're making your debut at the Centaur next week. I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for coming on Upstage this evening.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
That is the voice of Diane Flax, who is the creator and the performer of Guilt, A Love Story. It will be running at Centaur Theatre starting next week. Previews begin early in the week, and then premiere is on the Friday. Tickets until the 30th of March, between $30 and $68. For that and more, visit centaurtheatre.com. You can see some of the photos I was mentioning there. You can also call the box office at 514-288-3161. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Still to come on the show, what happens next after Just for Laughs takes the summer off? But next, Teasery Dunia hosts a touring show that questions the fallout of industrial pollution on a community in Ontario. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Great conversation there with the star of Guilt, A Love Story. And now we move to another creator, writer, and performer who will be starring in a show visiting Montreal starting next week. And Xander, I'm going to turn this over to you. Welcome. It's nice to see you.
Always happy to
be here.
Missed
you last week.
Yeah, I was temporarily dead, but now I'm okay,
I think. You're looking so great now.
Oh, thanks. I moisturize. So, Montreal isn't a stranger to industrialization. Its rapid mechanization was marred with disease, pollution, and a grotesquely high infant mortality rate in its early days. The sky was always gray, and the St. Lawrence River, still an enduring joke despite the fact that it's cleaned up a little, was kind of a shade of green. I say this to create some contrast, as the show we'll be talking about today deals with industrial pollution. Though, while we'd like to believe that Montreal, let alone Canada's air quality issues, had largely become a thing of the past, this show deals with an inconvenient present. Tisserie Dunia's theater and Broadleaf Creative's joint project, the Chemical Valley Project, discusses the inherent harm, pollution, and poisoning of Sarnia, Ontario, bitterly known as the Chemical Valley, as well as the Omgenon First Nations people. Starting from March 13th to the 24th at the Ragshella Studio, you will be able to see this show, and we'll be joined today with the co-creator and performer of the piece, Kevin Matthew Wong. Welcome to Upstage.
Thanks so much, Sander. It's great to be here.
Always happy to talk about these really important shows. Now, I believe this is actually the first time you're mounting this here in Montreal, am I right?
That's true. It's our first time in Montreal, first time in Quebec as well.
Yeah. And how are you feeling bringing this to an entirely new audience?
You know, it's an exciting thing for us. When we started creating the show, we wanted to create something that we could pack up in our car and spread as far and wide as we could across Canada. We actually also got to the west coast of Canada and even to Germany, but we've never been to Quebec. So it's actually really exciting to be in our neighboring province. We created this show in Toronto primarily, and it's a city that we're all very fond of. So we're excited to really get connected to the cultural community and to theater goers and audiences in Montreal.
Well, I mean, yeah, I took a look at the show's touring history. Like, you've been all over Ontario, Germany, as you've mentioned, which was you really kind of overshot our province quite a bit,
yeah,
by an entire ocean there, right?
Yeah, a little bit too far.
You know, and also BC. Earliest mentions of the show I found was back in 2016, I believe. So to say that a lot's really happened since then, yeah, is kind of a minor statement. I wonder, you know, because of the heavy nature of the show, how has it really evolved since, you know, you first started working on this piece?
Yeah, I feel what's really exciting for me as an artist is being able to live with a piece for this long. I don't think any of the creators thought that we would still be doing this show 8 years later when we'd first started it. Not to mention all of the huge national and global events that have taken place since then. What's I've really found about doing the show over and over again is it really relates to this concept, I think, of oral storytelling in Indigenous traditions. Like, you repeat a story and it gains meaning as you keep telling it. And you grow with the story. And the way that you tell the story evolves a little bit as you get older and more mature. And I think what's really interesting about the piece is what you're going to see in Montreal is a version of me, present-day me, recounting what a younger me was going through as they were discovering this, what they felt was a really untold story in the Canadian, you know, in the Canadian history books, in the news, in conversation, common conversation in Canada. And so what I really appreciated is each time we get this other chance to revisit it. And I think what also happens is the version that you get in Montreal is our most refined version of the show. It's the parts of the show that we love the most that stood the test of time. Because we actually do change the show for every time that we perform it, and we change it slightly for every theater that we go to.
Oh, wow. And I'd imagine so, since, you know, it does relate to oral storytelling. And that actually kind of brings me to my next question here. Like, you know, there's a mention of multimedia elements, and I'm seeing, like, from your press materials, from pictures from your previous show, from the previous iterations of your show, there's a lot of projection and all that stuff. I wonder how that kind of works with the nature, with the very organic nature of oral storytelling.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's also something that we address actually in a scene near the end of the show without giving too much away. But, you know, what's interesting for us is our journey into bringing all that multimedia into the show was kind of twofold. One was kind of showing the actual way that I started to hear about this story, which was quite digital. If it wasn't for me Googling, I wouldn't have stumbled upon the Chemical Valley, and I wouldn't have stumbled upon Vanessa and Beezy's activism, the two activists that we created this piece with. And then the other part of it is also that we work in a form called documentary theater, which is actually much more popular in Quebec than it is in Ontario. And for us, the documentary media that we were playing with was audio recordings with Vanessa and Beezy, who appear throughout the show in documentary media, but also their own recorded content of experiences that they've had in their community. So this multimedia universe gave us this opportunity to present these real things in the world in a theatrical context and make them more engaging than, say, watching them on your cell phone or watching them on your laptop. But the goal of us is always to use this media to augment the story and to make the experience of being together in space more alive than if we were all separated on our screens watching these videos at home.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, ever since 2020, more than ever, we're kind of all in our little pod, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And, I mean, speaking about that kind of isolation that we often kind of endure, especially, you know, when we're young as well, all the information that we're taking, especially, you know, growing up, say in the 2000s, like in the pre-mass exposure of the internet really took hold, right? Like all of our information was carefully filtered through, you know, academic curriculums, search engine protections, and so on and so forth. So, like, really, this subject specifically, along with a lot of struggles and a lot of history related to First Nations people, are not really taught in schools. I wonder if you can talk about your experience in discovering that, and, you know, how did that kind of inform you as an artist going forward?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate from my experience of going to school. You know, my history teachers had so much more enthusiasm teaching European history and colonial history than they had on any of the units, if there even were any, the years that I was in school about Indigenous history on these lands. I think a lot has changed since we started that show, and definitely has changed a lot since I went to school. Yeah, I think that it was actually a huge surprise to me. You know, this whole journey that we're sharing through the show is also the journey of an individual coming to a realization about this huge untold story in Canada. And this person, I say person or character of Kevin, because Kevin went through this journey, starting 8 years ago, it's they're coming to maturity as well. And they're coming to terms with calling themselves a Canadian. You know, what sort of inheritance are they receiving as a second-generation immigrant here? What sorts of questions do they have to wrestle with in order to be good with calling themselves a Canadian today? I think what's also really exciting is the perspective that these new media that we're sharing in the show. For example, we start the show early on, where we show a video that Vanessa took during an incredibly alarming flaring event. It's when there's a controlled gas leak out of one of these petrochemical factories in Sarnia. And that video I saw live on Facebook. And it was incredible. And it was this moment of feeling this weird synchronicity with something bad that was happening on. Like, we could see this horrible event taking place live online. And also it was interesting because that digital interaction wouldn't have been possible before, as you said, and it allowed for so much closeness. I felt that even though I wasn't with Vanessa, she was not only sharing this with whomever would be open to experiencing it, but I was also empathizing so deeply because I was literally almost seeing through her eyes that day.
Yeah, I mean, the evolution of social media really has allowed us to, in a way, kind of broaden or to break through a lot of these filters that we were often kind of comforted into, especially when it came to, you know, being a Canadian, you know, how our history when we're taught in high school, kind of was meant to essentially create this false illusion of what we are, what can, being a Canadian is supposedly to mean. And, you know, I'd like to ask, actually, because we're running up here, unfortunately, because I'd love to keep on talking about not only your show, but also, the situation there. But, you know, what would you like your audience to walk away from your show with? If there's best case scenario, full intentions, you know, are met as an author, as a creator, as a performer, as an activist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started this company that I run called Broadleaf to try to address environmental issues through the theater. And I always think of our audience as just on the precipice of taking action or of, you know, getting more involved in what they're doing. And our role isn't to get them to that place. It's to just encourage them to take that next step. And so I think the real thing that I hope that audiences come away with is that encouragement to get engaged in their community, to get engaged with these, not only these conversations, but these actions that are taking place. And to really leave feeling hopeful and that they have power, rather than leaving feeling like they're overwhelmed or that they don't have a part to play in this story that we're co-writing, which is the story of Canada. So I really hope that the play makes for more engaged citizens, more empathetic citizens, and that we have lots of conversations that lead to action and solidarity for the community of Anishinaabe and for other Indigenous communities across the country.
I couldn't have hoped for anything better myself, Kevin. I cannot understate how important shows like these are. More than ever, we're stuck in our little internet pods, apartments, houses, and cubicles, and I really do appreciate you coming on to talk about this show. The Chemical Valley Project can be seen from March 13th to the 24th at the Ragshala Studio. More information can be found at tsridunyatheatre.ticketleap.com, or you can call 514-848-0238.
Thank you so much, Sandra. That was fascinating. I cannot wait to see that show. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Still to come, in the second half of the show, we will find out about Amour Acide et Noir, a daring show when it first opened 23 years ago. Four dancers, all in the nude, talking about sensitivity and emotionality. We'll have a conversation with the rehearsal director in just a moment. But first, no ha 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 this July. I'm going to have a conversation with Elspeth Wright, Montreal-based comedian and producer, about the demise, temporarily, we hope, of Just for Laughs.
We used to be friends a long time ago.
Welcome back to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Some Dandy Warhols there. We used to be friends. They are going to be performing at the Studio TD on Monday night. And I'm thinking of going. These guys from the, oh my gosh, they've been around for like something like 25 years. The Studio TD used to be known as the As L'Astral. Sorry, mixing up my venues here. And from time to time, that venue sometimes would host a comedy show. The area, of course, for 2 weeks in July, Place des Arcadies becomes awash with comedy fans. Tourists from abroad, but Montrealers, of course, turning out in droves to support the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. Hard to believe, first founded in 1983, the festival has since become truly like a part of the fabric of our city and really continues to enforce our reputation as the city of festivals. But shocking news this week when the festival announced that not only was it filing for bankruptcy and creditor protection, but they'd also laid off something like 70% of their staff over the past couple of months, including layoffs in December before the holidays. Bailiffs headed out last week to seize some of the festival's property as well. But what is impacting comedy fans and comedians most of all is that there will be no festival for 2024 in Montreal nor in Toronto at the Offshoot Festival, which happens every fall. They are hoping to be back for 2025. Elspeth Wright is a Montreal-based comedian and producer, a very busy artist, and she joins me on the line to tell us her thoughts. Hello, Elspeth.
Hello.
Scrolling through my Facebook feed this week, it was comedian after comedian going, what? A lot of shock, I think, shared not just by the community, but people who love going to the festival. Elspeth, what was your thoughts when the news broke on Tuesday?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of shock. You know, as a comedian and, you know, a fan of comedy, it was really unexpected and quite shocking and sad to see that it won't be happening this year.
I know that there were rumblings about this and that money-wise. You know, it's a big, sprawling festival. I think we forget how big it is because there are shows not only in French and English, but there is also an industry kind of side conference that happens at the same time. And then there's licensing deals. So it's quite sprawling. There's been a lot of ambitious kind of like, you know, they had a festival in South Africa at some point. They're expanding to Toronto and Vancouver to do festival offshoots. I guess one of the thoughts was, you know, is the festival become too big? I know you're not someone reporting on the festival itself, but is that one of the things you've heard about?
I haven't heard anything about that, but I mean, it does make sense. It was getting really, really big. And yeah, there were a lot of offshoots, but to me that seemed promising and like it was, you know, giving more opportunities for more Canadian comedians, especially with the like Toronto and Vancouver shows. They seem to have a lot of like Canadian comedians on them.
Right.
So yeah, it's interesting.
You've been based in Montreal for a couple of years now. What does this festival mean to people trying to make it in comedy in the city?
I mean, for me, I got to do the Just for Laughs album recording in 2021. So it was right after the pandemic. I was asked to do the album while we were still in lockdown. So I didn't know if I was going to get to warm up or anything for it, which was interesting. And at that point I was about, you know, a year and a half into comedy, and that getting to do that album and having that Just for Laughs credit really, really opened a lot of doors for me. So it is a really important festival, and being able to say you've performed at Just for Laughs sort of gives people an idea that you're up to a certain standard. You know, not to say those who haven't performed there aren't, but, you know, it's a very good credit to have, and it's a very important festival in that way.
Yeah, it shows that you can deliver. You can work a room.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
When you did this recording, was it jittery? Was it a scary experience to know that, you know, just kind of what was hanging in the balance?
Yeah. I mean, I still get nervous anytime I go on stage, you know, because I always want to do my best. I was incredibly nervous during that recording, for sure. I walked off stage and was just like didn't remember anything I had done, but I remembered that the crowd had laughed and that there had been applause. So I was like, I think I did well. So yeah, I sort of like blacked out with anxiety, but it was fun.
What are you hearing from other comics in the Montreal scene? Hearing, you know, what is like, is there a sense of loss? Is there grief for people processing?
I think everyone is still pretty shocked and processing it. I think everyone's quite sad about it because it is such a good opportunity not only to, you know, potentially get this amazing credit, but also to see some of our favorite comedians, you know. All comedians are fans of comedy, and it's so fun to just get to go out and see these world-class acts and just hang out in an area that's really celebrating comedy. So it's going to be, you know, a little weird this summer, I think, without the festival, and I think people are sort of processing that.
What does it mean in terms of finances? Like, to know that not everyone obviously makes it into a local comic showcase or gets to do the bigger shows. It's still a hard thing to achieve. But not having that business in town this July, what does that mean for Montreal Comics?
I think for us, to be honest, most Montreal comedians have sort of like day jobs.
Yeah.
The festival is nice if you get it. I don't think anyone's really relying on getting booked at the festival to, you know, secure rent for the month or anything like that. It's more of a what the festival can lead to in that sort of way. But.
I'm speaking with Elspeth Wright, who's a Montreal-based comedian and producer, and we're talking about the fallout of the shocking news this week that Just for Laughs is taking a break this summer, but it's also in some financial disarray, seeking creditor and bankruptcy protection. The news broke earlier this week, and also the offshoot happening in Toronto every fall is not going to be happening this year. Elspeth, I know that the industry is changing everywhere. So many different businesses are kind of confronted with the pandemic and people's changing media consumption habits and ways of doing things. The cost of putting on live entertainment has practically doubled in the pandemic, according to some estimates. And then also comedy is so accessible on TikTok and on Instagram online. Has the comedy business changed for good? And, you know, does that make it harder to run a comedy festival, you think?
I don't know. I think TikTok has changed comedy in the way that some crowds are expecting sort of more crowd work and sort of a different dynamic between like the comedian and the audience, which is an interesting thing to navigate. But I think it's also made it, like you said, a little more accessible. I think what people need to realize, though, is that like you can access local live comedy at any time. You know, like you don't just have to watch comedy on TikTok or just at, you know, the Just for Laughs Festival. Like, live comedy is happening every night, like multiple shows a night in Montreal. So I think that the festival sort of taking a break this year will hopefully shine a light on that.
That it's so funny. That was one of the things I thought of, because I know there's tons of shows happening. Comedy Nest, for one. We think of the Mike Ward-supported comedy venue. I'm blanking on it. Demaison near Saint-Denis.
Bordel,
thank you. There's one more out east near Beaudry Metro. And then there's so many independent shows happening in English in various little pockets all over town. So there is a lot happening. But I'm wondering if maybe, because the festival had as its lore that the power to make a star, someone like the star of Home Improvement, the Santa Claus. Oh my gosh, I told myself I was going to blank.
Tim Allen,
who showed up and was a star the very next day after he performed. But are people's careers still being made at festivals and at live appearances? You know, when there's so much pressure to be online, for instance, like to have a TikTok reel and to be on Instagram. Like, do you need a festival to make it?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, having the festival definitely helps, and the festival still does make careers, but there are plenty of comedians who are getting famous from TikTok. There's a whole just subset of comedians who are TikTok comedians and are famous for their crowd work or for, you know, their skits that they do on TikTok. And so it's changing, but I think, you know, being part of a major festival is still incredibly helpful and can still make a career.
Yeah, wise words. Elspeth, it's been really nice to get this perspective from you. Where can we see you performing or producing next?
I produce a weekly show with two other people, Mary Kringles and Lauren Mallory, called Stand Up St. Henry. It's at the Montreal Improv in St. Henry every Tuesday, and we try to highlight femme and queer performers. It's a really fun show.
That's absolutely fabulous. And where are you going to be on stage next?
Tonight, I'm actually at a show, again, in St. Henry at Satay Brothers called Kickback, which I'm really looking forward to.
Elspeth, that's a restaurant. You're performing there on Notre Dame?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, comedy is happening everywhere, including Satay Brothers, which is a delicious, delicious restaurant. And how can we follow you online if you'd like to catch you in person?
Yeah, just follow me on Instagram at Elspeth_Wright.
Perfect. Elspeth, great to have you on the show. Can't wait to see you in person. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye.
That is the voice of Elspeth Wright. As she said, you can catch her on Instagram, Elspeth_Wright, ELSPETH. I love that name. And then Wright, WRIGHT. So RIP for Just for Laughs, at least for this year. Love to wait and see what happens for the 2025 edition. But the festival is facing, I have to say, some serious issues. We're listening to a little bit of the gags intro theme here. I'm going to leave you with that and get our next guest on the line. Justin Gionnet has had a front row seat to the development and touring of Amour Acide et Noir over the past 23 years. This Quebec show is getting a review with different performers next week at Agora de la Danse. We'll find out more in just a moment.
Heavy Trip and CKUT present an evening with Revenge International recording artists Horse Lords and Colbert. A new Grammy double whammy. Chalk a block with Sonic Tomfoolery. Live at Sotrania on Saturday, March 16th. Tickets on sale now. For more information, visit www.google.com.
Regresa el ídolo más esperado, Chayanne. Chayanne. Con su gira mundial Bailemos Otra Vez.
Lo dejaría todo porque te quedas.
15 de noviembre, Bell Center. A la venta este viernes 8 de marzo por Ticketmaster.com. Chayanne regresa en su gira Bailemos Otra Vez. Produce CMN.
Classic Roy Orbison for you there with Oh Pretty Woman. Just finding out that Xander, I said to Xander, do you love the song or do you hate the song? And what did you say, Xander?
Oh, yeah, I was raised on Roy Orbison.
We are playing some Wright Orbison because Pretty Woman the Musical with music by Jim Ballance and Brian Adams is on now at Place des Arts. A couple more showings. I caught the opening Tuesday. It was a lot of fun. It really does pull a lot from the movie, but it's quite entertaining. A very simple kind of musical, actually. It's kind of fun to just see a very pure love story with just a couple of side plots happening. So if you're looking for some musical fun with two very attractive people in the leads, do check out Pretty Woman the Musical at Sal Wilfer Peltier for a couple more showings this week. It's a touring Broadway show. Those are always so much fun. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our final conversation for the evening is going to be about a dance show that is kind of a really iconic piece in the Quebec canon, directed by, choreographed by Danielle Léveillé, who first broke out in the scene some decades ago. And the piece first debuted in 2001 at Agora de la Danse, and it's since traveled in the past 23 years all over the world, really cementing Danielle's reputation as a modern dance choreographer. When you see the images and the trailers for it, it's truly iconic. Four dancers, three men, one woman, and they are completely in the nude. It's like so fascinating to watch their muscles move ever so slowly. It's a show that touches on intimacy, but distance as well. It is coming back to Agora de la Danse next week, March 13th to the 15th. Tickets are very affordable, and this is going to be really, really fun for huge dance fans. But they have a totally new cast for this particular production. Someone who's been with the show as it's been touring over the years, practically since the beginning, is Justin Gionnet, who is rehearsal director for Amour, Acide et Noir. And he joins us on the line. Welcome, Justin.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. What makes this show so iconic, not just for Danielle's own canon as a choreographer, but iconic as a Quebec dance piece?
Great question. Let's see. I think it had a really huge influence, I think. And Danielle, in addition to being a university professor, has had like a huge influence on the Quebec dance scene that I think you can see in a whole bunch of different artists that are currently like the younger generation that are creating work. But this particular piece is just to talk about like the style of it. It's really, really minimalist. Like obviously the costumes are super minimalist, but there's a lot of stillness in the piece. And a lot of the work focuses on like how to maintain your intention and focus without actually doing so much. And then how to make the movements that when they do happen, be really explosive.
Yeah. What is that like for the dancers themselves? Because they are moving at such a slow pace, but then, yeah, like a burst of action, like someone leaps into the arms of someone else on stage. How is that challenging for their bodies?
So it's challenging because you don't have the, you can't fall back on the movement. You really have to be in touch with your focus and with your intention, so that when the movement does happen, it's a decision that the dancer makes, and that's what the audience sees, is the preparation and the decision. And I don't know, I think that's fascinating.
It truly is. Can I ask a kind of a silly question? But since the dancers are nude on stage, you're a rehearsal director, so you're working really intimately with them. What challenges does that pose? Like, I'm just imagining being cold for one, but also like being exposed to the environment around them.
That's a fair question. Most of the time we don't rehearse. Ironically, we actually call performing naked being in costume because it is the costume for the show.
Okay.
So it's kind of a misnomer, but so we call a run in costume when we actually perform it naked. Most of the time we rehearse like with clothes on. But there are some of the moves that are actually a lot easier when they're performed without any clothing. A lot of lift work, for example, if there's clothing in between the two layers of skin, it can become really slippery, especially with baggy clothing. So having like lift work that we can do with like a hand on a torso is often more secure and safer than when there's clothing in the way. But like I said, we do our best to keep our dancers warm and safe.
Of course. Dancers are obviously also very comfortable with their bodies because they spend so much time in them and working and performing. But is it gênant? Is it difficult to be fully in costume or in the nude in front of an audience?
That is actually something that we talk about with them. Part of the creation process, something that we ask every new dancer is to think about well beforehand who would the most challenging audience member for them be. And like the answers are usually very revealing. They don't have to share them, but just to have the dancers think about who would make you uncomfortable, and would you be able to do this if they were in the audience? So that is something that the entire team has the performers think about, consider before they even like embark on the journey.
We're not outing anybody, but I'm assuming the answers are something like maybe parents or
the answer for
frenemies.
Me was my father.
Your father.
When I was performing it, I was like, I would be really, really challenged if my father came to see this. Because he's always been supportive, but he's never come to see.
Oh, okay. That's the thing that he hasn't been able to come see yet, because it's so, so personal.
It's very personal. It's true. But that was my answer. My answer would be my father. Because he's always, he just doesn't really enjoy contemporary dance.
It's
really
no.
what it is. So he's like, I'm really happy that you're happy.
Oh.
This isn't for me. It's not my cup of tea.
Okay.
So for me, that was my answer. But like, it could be anybody. Yeah. It could be your significant other, or maybe you're just really open and comfortable, like being on stage without any costume on. It's actually a really great costume in terms of as long as you are comfortable with it. Because it always fits.
Yeah.
And you can't like lose it in the airplane luggage.
No.
And like, it's really easy to clean. And it's actually really like resilient. It repairs itself if it's ever damaged. Like, it's great.
That is so well put, Justin. I think, yeah, my fear would be like being clean, being wondering if I smell or if there's something that like, if I spilt coffee on myself right beforehand, is it on me somewhere on my leg and I didn't notice? I'm speaking with Justin Gionnet, who is the rehearsal director for Amour, Acid et Noir. And as you just mentioned, also a performer for the show, A Long History. It's toured for 23 years and it's coming back to Montreal at Agora, the place where it originated 23 years ago. So what is it like to dance this piece?
What's it like to dance this piece? Like I said, there's a lot of stillness, and then that stillness is punctuated by really, really technically difficult dance work. This particular piece has a lot of focus on partnering and lift work. If you do come and see, you'll notice that there's a lot of duos, I think that was something. Oh gosh. Sorry, my cat knocked something over. Everything's okay. There's a lot of focus on lift work and partnering, but from the audience point of view, that goes a long way towards creating characters and relationships. So like getting to see a man and a woman do a certain set of lifts and then a man and a man do a set of lifts is a really, really different experience. There's also four solos. So there's periods of time when the dancers are on stage just by themselves, which is super intimate. You really get to see each performer, like down to their core. And as a performer, being on stage during those moments is super exciting for me, at least. Just because you have so much control, you're so much in charge of the entire space and everyone's experience.
There is a nice image I was able to share on our Instagram, which is one of the lifts happening where kind of one person is on the diagonal, lifted up on the shoulders of another. It seems so technically challenging a show.
It is. It really is.
It doesn't seem like it because it's just four people in the nude in front of you, but it is technically challenging.
It is technically very challenging. It's not a super aerobic show because, like I said, there's a lot of stillness. But in terms of anaerobic sort of experience, it was like the movement is really like explosive when it does happen. So you have to be ready for it, and you only get the one shot because once the movement is done, you have to go right back to that stillness.
Mm-hmm.
It's very high contrast.
The last thing I want to ask you about, Justin, is just what this means for, I guess, Daniel's career and his work and the people around him as well to have the show come back to where it all started some 23 years ago.
Yeah, we talked to him about that, and he, for years, had zero interest in bringing the show back. I think he felt that the show had run its course, which is fair. It toured for like 16 years or something like that. And literally, went all over the world. I think he was tired of it, which is fair. But then somebody pointed out to him that the piece hadn't been performed in Montreal in decade? In a decade?
I think the last time was 2016, yeah, at La Chapelle.
Or something like that, yeah. And there's basically an entire generation of audience, of creators, of performers, of dance enthusiasts who have never seen it.
Which makes it a perfect choice to be at the Agora next week. Justin, I have to run, but I have to thank you so much for being so frank and so open about all these little questions about the kind of the ins and outs of being a dancer and just what this piece has meant to the community. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
That is the voice of Justin Gionnet, who is rehearsal director and also has danced in the show Amour, Acide et Noir. It marks 23 years this year and is going to be performed at Agora de la Danse next week. For tickets and more information, visit agoradance.com, 514-525-1500, and billetterie@agoradance.com. Tickets are $29 to $35. A very big thank you to my guests, including Justin, Elspeth Wright, Kevin Matthew Wong, and Diane Flax. And thank you to Xander for doing an amazing job speaking with Kevin earlier this hour. For updates and more, visit us on Instagram at UpstageCKUT. We'll be back next week with more stories about theater in Montreal. And thank you so much for tuning in and joining us this evening. Have fun and stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters with my friend Fortner Anderson. Have a nice evening.
People throw different labels around. You are this or you are that.
Everybody psychoanalyzes someone during a conversation.
You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, AMI Quebec, Ford House, or Prevention Suicide.
Good evening and welcome to the March 7th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture by Andrew Seidel. He's a constitutional attorney, he's vice president of Americans for Separation of Church and State, and he is author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. The lecture was recorded in Madison, Wisconsin on November 14th of 2022. Its title is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Here it is.
The Crusaders are setting up these cases, case after case after case, claiming religious freedom, and then the conservative justices are coming through, and it's a collaboration.